Empower Radio presents The Miracle of Healing with Lisa Campion. Meet healers, learn different modalities, and hear empowering stories of people on their healing journey. The Miracle of Healing on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Lisa Campion.
Hello, I'm Lisa Campion, and this is The Miracle of Healing on Empower Radio, where conscious people come together to explore the world of healing and heal the planet, one person at a time. I maybe have to change that because it's so many people at a time now, and that's a beautiful thing. And today we're going to talk about achieving non-symbolic consciousness. And can there be a science behind enlightenment? And I'm very, very pleased to introduce Jeffrey Martin. He is an author, an educator, scientist, tech guru, serial entrepreneur. His CV is incredible. Like it's really impressive. And he has, we're going to discuss his 10 years of scientific research that he's done in the field of consciousness, human consciousness, and psychology. He's really got it down to a science about how we can reach new levels of well-being, which include inner peace, happiness, and transcendence. So welcome so much today, Jeffrey. I'm super happy to have you here.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here with you.
So I'm curious a little bit about how did you go from being a incredibly successful entrepreneur, I think you're still sort of a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, to studying human consciousness? How did that transition happen?
It's really simple and selfish, actually. I just looked around one day and realized that there seemed to be people who were happier than I was, despite how hard I was working and despite that I was doing everything that the world said, you know, that I was supposed to be doing to be, you know, uber happy and uber successful and sort of maxing out human life. And I started thinking to myself, okay, well, if I stay on the same track that I'm on, I'm probably going to wind up just like this 10 years from now, 20 years from now, whereas these other people seem to have an even richer, happier life than I do. So maybe I should go try to figure out what they're up to. And that's really where it started.
And so you were able to kind of refocus your career and spend some time studying at Harvard, I think, and the California Institute of Integral Studies to open up this field of consciousness. And you have sort of a unique name for what this non-symbolic consciousness. And I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit about what that is and why you use that term.
Sure. So I used that term actually because we had difficulty getting research participants to cooperate with us at the beginning of the research. And so we would use the terms that they used when we knew what they were. We would say enlightenment or non-duality or persistent mystical experience or the peace that passeth understanding or sort of whatever tradition, you know, they were a part of. We'd say experience or consciousness and all of these words wound up being landmines. What turned out to be the case was that often what people had publicly put out there, and we were dealing mostly with public people at the very beginning of the research. What people had publicly put out there, they put out there years before, and it didn't actually necessarily match what they were thinking today, but they were kind of trapped in their former books and paradigms and language and whatever else. And so we would come to them as scientists and say, we'd like to study your, you know, form of consciousness, you know, your enlightenment or whatever. And they would be like, it's not enlightenment experience, it's enlightenment consciousness, or it doesn't have anything to do with consciousness, it's about experience. And so we had difficulty getting them to cooperate. And we're like, okay, we've got to stop trying to use these people's phrases because, you know, something's going on here. And even though we're trying to match their own language, it's not really working out very well for us. So we started to test a whole bunch of other terms. And there was a term that was used by a lady named Suzanne Cook-Greuter, who's a really fantastic researcher. She did her PhD at Harvard under a developmentalist named Keegan, who is one of the world's leading, if not the world's leading, developmental psychologist. And she looked at sort of these further reaches of human development, you might call it. And in a 2000 paper, she used the term non-symbolically mediated consciousness. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of a cool word. Let's put that on the list. We changed it to non-symbolic consciousness. And the first research subject that I said it to was like, yeah, okay, you know, when do you want to come by? And that was it. We stuck with that term.
So that's not a term
that actually emerged from all of our research. It's a term that enabled all of our research, basically.
Wow. And so you've researched, I don't know, thousands of people, right, to kind of find the common denominators in how we achieve that. And before we talk about the research, can you define a little bit about what that state of consciousness means to you? Like how would we experience it?
Absolutely. So there are many different forms of it. That's the first thing that I think is important to realize. Many people often think that there's sort of one correct version of it, or that it's some sort of unified construct of experiences, but that's not actually the case. And it took us years and years and years just to try to figure out what might be common across all of the different types of experience. And that was actually an extraordinarily frustrating part of the research, because we just kept crossing things one after another off the list. And at one point, it looked like everything was sort of crossed off the list. And then we realized, okay, well, wait a minute. There is kind of one thing that goes across all of these different forms of the experience, and that is a very deep sense of a change in your psychology away from what we think of as sort of the more animal nature of humans, which is a sense that everything is not quite okay in the moment, you know, kind of a fundamental sense of discontentment that's very, very important for every animal's survival. So it's not at all surprising that humans have that, just like every other animal does. But you know, being realistic, most of us are living remarkably safe lives these days. And so there isn't really the same need that we have versus, you know, an animal that could be eaten in the next moment, you know, even though it's feeding on our bird feeder outside our window, you know, or he doesn't see the cat from the neighbor's yard lurking, you know, hungrily at it. You know, we just don't have that sort of situation. Most of us that
not too many saber-tooth tigers hanging around, and you know,
no saber-tooth tigers hanging around. We're not likely to get our arms ripped off anytime soon by some wild animal or anything like that, unless we have extreme camping tendencies. And so, realistically, one of the things that the main thing that happens, and the main thing that goes across all of the people that experience fundamental well-being, is a shift where that old part of our programming of our nervous system basically switches. Mm. And instead of feeling a sense of fundamental discontentment, you feel a sense that things are fundamentally okay. And that can actually be kind of confusing, because if you're boss is looking across the table at you and says, you know, you're fired and you're never going to work in this industry again. I'm going to ruin you. Strangely, if you look down past whatever negative emotions you might still be feeling about that, somehow paradoxically, everything feels okay. Right. And you're sort of like, how can things possibly be okay? Like everything.
I know. That's great. I mean, I find myself in that circumstance right now. Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's crazy out there. The news is like whack, you know, and I feel totally better than I ever have in my life. And I feel a little guilty saying that. I'm like happy. Things are going great for me. Like there's no real reason, I guess, why. It's just maybe I've dropped into that state myself, and I feel like a little shame about saying it. I'm like, don't tell anyone. Right. I'm like thriving and happy for no reason in the middle of a pandemic. I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm hearing that from a lot of people that are in, you know, fundamental well-being. And that same thing of like, you know, is it okay to actually say that?
Yeah.
No, thank God you're also in fundamental well-being. I can say it to you because you'll understand.
Okay. Like, I just outed myself on the radio. I don't know if there's going to be repercussions.
Judgment. Yeah. I mean, you know, we can still have we can have that feeling for ourselves, and there's nothing wrong, I think, with having that feeling for ourselves. And at the same time, we can understand that there are 30 million people, you know, out of work in America right now, and there are a lot of people going through hard times, and we can do things to help them. You know, we just ran another cohort of our 45 Days to Awakening experiment. They were like,
totally wanted to get in it. It was closed. So I'll try to get in the next one.
filled up very quickly. Awesome. We've only done a few of them. But so, you know, we did some things like we decided to, even though we make that, you know, it's a dirt cheap program, right? And it really, we can't really afford to run it, frankly. It's being supported mostly by volunteers and whatnot at this point. If we didn't have volunteers that were alumni helping us out, there's no way we could, you know, operate it. But even despite that, we thought, you know, we can at least take a small percentage of everyone's fees and we can donate it to, you know, meal-based organizations, or even tree planting. So we gave people the option of like, you know, you can plant a tree or you can donate 5 meals to people who really need it right now. And so, you know, we can do things like that. We can be very respectful of sort of the situation that other people are in. Running a program like that at a very inexpensive level that isn't even really sustainable at the level it's currently run at, and having it be a lot more time consuming because of wrangling volunteers and stuff like that. You know, they're all things. There's things that we can be okay in ourselves and be exactly like you're expressing. It's the same for me. Like I can't say that the pandemic has been a negative thing in any way in my life. And yet we can also, you know, help.
And maybe even more. I mean, maybe if we're in that state of well-being and we're really thriving in our own self, we have actually more. Takes us out of that sort of survival place where when all of our bandwidth is just getting through the day, you know, or kind of hustling, you know, and maybe we actually have more to contribute if we're in that state.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. Mm.
So going back to the research, somehow you got these research volunteers to come in and share their experience of this non-symbolic consciousness. And from that, you boiled it down into these specific characteristics or traits that they were experiencing, and then created a program to help people achieve that.
Right. The program actually came out of research as well. And so the initial program, which is still out there, is called the Finder's Course. And frankly, the reason it exists is not because we thought to ourselves, boy, it'd be really cool to create a program. But we reached the point where we wanted to get before and after data. It was the next logical progression from a scientific research standpoint. So for the first many years, for the first 6 years at least or so, 6-7 years, we could only go to people who purported to experience this and research them after the fact. And then we had to kind of take their word for, you know, how they got there, who they were before, which is never going to be that accurate, you know. Mm. And so the day basically came where we're like, okay, well, we're not really getting any new data after the fact. What can we do to try to measure people before they get there and to try to measure people while they're in the process of getting there, to try to measure then afterward and then see maybe how they develop and how life changes for them and what the patterns are on the other side of it. In order to do that, we had to be able to transition people. So that's actually where the programs come from. So the Finder's Course was a research program from 2014 until 2018. And then at the end of 2018, we actually took it down for a little while. And then, you know, so many people still wanted to just use it as a program that we put it back up as a program. And we allow, frankly, a pretty small number of people to take it every other month or so. Mm-hmm. It's less than like 50 people or so. Wow. And so, and then during the pandemic, I was actually doing brain stimulation research. We think the next frontier of this is zapping people's brains. The initial research wasn't done to really create the map that sort of become this publicly available map of fundamental well-being or persistent non-symbolic experience, as we call it in the academic sphere. But it was really created to sort people for neuroscience so that we could figure out what was going on in their brain. And so we did a lot of that. And once we had the map, then it was like, okay, what can we do with the map? How can we reach into their brains and stimulate them in different ways? And so we tried for years with many different technologies, but the regions of interest were always too deep in the brain to really get at. And just in the last couple of years, there's been a new technology called transcranial ultrasound. And we've been able to reach those areas in the brain in a non-invasive and safe way. And so we've been researching that. And then the pandemic hit, and you know, couldn't have people come into the lab and getting brain zapped and all of that anymore. Everybody was sort of locked in their houses. And so we were sitting around thinking, okay, well, what now? You know, what should we do? And we decided to create that follow-on protocol that I mentioned that you unfortunately weren't able to get into cohort 4 of, which was really derived from our earlier research protocol. And so what we noticed with the Finder's Course protocol was that roughly 70% of people would transition. And it was very reliable when people transitioned. So a certain percentage transitioned in the first half, a certain percentage transitioned by the three-quarter point, a certain percentage by the end. And so what we noticed is that roughly 60 of those 70% of people had transitioned by maybe 60% of the program. It would be through session 10. So that would be 8 weeks, 9, 10, basically through about 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so we were asking ourselves for a long time, like, hey, you know, maybe sometime we'll have an opportunity to just create a shorter version of this protocol. And, you know, maybe it can be more accessible to people because a 4-month protocol, the main protocol is 4 months long and it can take like 3 hours a day of wow. people's time and stuff like that. Yeah. It's a huge commitment. And that's one reason why not a lot of people can take advantage of it.
Right.
And it's another reason why it's very intensive for us to run. And it has sort of the limitations on it that we have to place in terms of, you know, it's a lot of support for people. It's a very intensive program, both for people going through it and for us to operate. And so we thought, well, let's see, you know, the COVID virus has hit. Everybody's kind of sitting at home. This, you know, we can't do our research that we're currently working on. So let's see if we can create a shorter version of the protocol. And we went ahead and did that. We called it 45 Days to Awakening. It's basically we tried to get that 10 weeks down to 6 weeks. And, you know, it worked out pretty well. It wound up being about a 64% transition rate, which was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I thought we'd probably get to 50%. Transition rate. So it actually exceeded my expectations.
That you're making it more accessible. And now the techniques that you use are they meditation techniques? Like what is it that you're having people do?
The Finder's Course protocol was people that were in, you know, fundamental well-being and persistent non-symbolic experience and us basically asking them, hey, what worked for you? And so we took and we sorted all of that data. And it turns out that not like 50 million things rose to the top, like a relatively manageable number of things rose to the top. And so we started experimenting with those. We looked at them and we thought, you know, we can see how this would work for some people. But with our knowledge of neuroscience and the brain and whatnot, we're like, you know, I bet you if we just make a couple of tweaks here and there on this method, it would probably be a lot more effective, you know, for more people. And so we did a lot of experimentation like that. We wound up with a relatively tight, modified cocktail of these methods that had worked for people over the years. But we had a problem that came from that as well. And the problem was that some of those were so intensive that they would produce what are called in the meditation world, dark night experiences. People would have intense depression, you know, long-term intense depression. If you look at Willoughby Britton's work at Brown, you know, she talks a lot about this type of thing.
Yeah. All the trauma comes up, like all the unexplored trauma, everything comes up to the surface. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, these are heavy lifting methods. Mm-hmm. And so we had to really ask, you know, this is research being done in a university lab, right? And so you can't just like make people depressed for decades. And so we had to ask ourselves, how do you circumnavigate that? You know, is there a way around that? It took about a year to engineer around that. And what we learned is that there were a couple of, you know, things that needed to be done basically to engineer around that. The first was that people needed to have a certain baseline of happiness before they went into those harder core methods. Right. And so that modified the protocol. It made it twice as long, took it from originally it was like 6 weeks long. And so that took it up to basically 4 months with adding all of these positive psychology interventions in and all of these leading sort of ways that psychology had developed to make people happier. And then the other thing that people needed was a positive initial glimpse. And so, you know, if you have a temporary experience of fundamental well-being, non-symbolic experience, whatever you want to call it today, that is like any other temporary transcendent experience. They can be positive or they can be negative. You know, people have near-death experiences and some people go to heaven and some people go to hell, right? Yep. People have drug experiences and some people have awesome drug experiences, psychedelic experiences, and some people have hellish psychedelic experiences. Well, it's basically just another self-transcendent experience, and people can have a good one and they can have a bad one. And if they have a bad one, more or less like they're thrown down the road oftentimes of, you know, a long protracted period of negative internal emotional states that's become called the dark night of the soul and stuff like that. And so we also had to engineer things into the system so that we could give people a positive and safe initial glimpse of it, you know, really sort of bias their first experience if they hadn't had one before in that direction. And so all of that, you know, kind of combines together to make this 4-month cocktail. And then we were able to keep a lot of that in the 6-week protocol as well.
That's so interesting. It I love it that you're like, I feel like mystics have stumbled into this stuff, and you know,
Totally.
religious leaders and mystics, you know, across the centuries, psychics and spiritual people. That's sort of more my side of the fence. And I just think it's so fantastic that you've brought it into a science lab and are like, you know, finding out the. It feels like you can dodge all those landmines, and like we've all done it. Old school, the hard way, you know, and that you guys have really streamlined it with that science and probably pretty, you know, progressed the science of understanding consciousness, which is like kind of like besides quantum, like the frontier, you know, the new frontier of really understanding how we get to be who we are and what do we do to maximize that, like to reach our full potential. So I think it's great. I love it. I'm very, I'm happy and pleased that you're doing that and that you're offering it to people. Are you going to have an at-home brain zapper that we can do, like, you know, like, like to zap the brain?
I sure hope so. You know, I certainly think so. One thing that's been just in the last month or so, even sort of with our experiments with our closer research partners who we can be around during COVID, we've started to experiment with nerve-based zapping instead of brain-based zapping. So like zapping the vagus nerve at the neck with the same type of technology. And we're seeing remarkable effects from it as well. So that would make it available a lot more rapidly, because right now the FDA and other regulatory bodies don't really know what to think about the whole brain zapping thing with ultrasound, or like they don't really have. Now they're kind of still building their teams and still building their opinions about it and you know how it can roll out and stuff like that. And so that means we're looking at years and years and years and years and years of bureaucratic delays for something that's brain-based in most Western countries. I mean, not if you're in Mexico or India or China or something like that, right? And so but the neck one is a very well established thing. And so if that actually pans out, there could be a device that was much more rapidly and widely available. And so, yeah, you know, we're doing our best. I think it's probably 10 years away, 5-10 years away at least, if it stays at the brain level. But if it stays at the neck level, it could come a lot quicker.
That's awesome. So how can people find you if they wanted? I know you've written a lot of books. We haven't even had time really to talk about your books. I'd love to, because that's super interesting too. But and I know that you did them in kind of a calculated way. It wasn't like a creative, you know, expression of yourself. It was more part of your research. But how can people find your material, your books, your research, or be part of the Finders course?
Yeah, absolutely. The research is at nonsymbolic.org. And so that's our main research site. And so if people just want to find a whole bunch of information, you know, that's more or less, you just click on the publications page there and that's the spot to go. And that has links to some of our other, I'm pretty sure that has links to the other programs as well. I don't think of that site as a site for the, you know, there's a lot of the programs now, but I'm sure there's a page on there that our staff has put on there for that. The programs are, you know, the Finders course is still out there. It's still running, at least as we make this video. And so that's finderscourse.com. 45 Days to Awakening is, I'm sure, going to run again. You know, we're really trying to figure out how we can make that sustainable and what is the pricing that we can do to actually keep that running, and how well will the volunteer thing work out. And, you know, we're really in early days of sort of testing, you know, what's possible there. So that's, you know, 45daystoawakening.com or 45days.one, really either one will get you to one place. So, and then we have other programs to help people that are finders. And so, you know, we have a book, of course, that covers our core research called The Finders, that is more or less available everywhere in the world. And then for people who are finders, that's another big part of our research. And so, you know, like it turns out getting people there is, I know people don't believe this, but it's kind of the easy part. The challenge for people really comes on the other side of the transition to fundamental well-being, really sort of understanding this entirely new developmental path that you find yourself on. And there's more or less nothing out there.
There's really nothing out there. There's barely anything because I've, so I've read it all.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we have a program that was our first experimental program around this called the Explorers Course, which actually there's a free mini version of it called the Explorers Mini Course that's at explorerscourse.com. And so people can sort of find that there. And then we've started a new program just this year, which is called the Exemplar Program. And the Explorers Course is, you know, sort of been really great for people that just kind of want to go deeper into fundamental well-being, kind of want fundamental well-being for fundamental well-being's sake, if you will. Mm. They sort of are, you know, happy going off to the cave and whatever else. But there's a whole ton of other people that really want to integrate this better into their life. Right. You know, it's not about like selling everything and buying a cabin, you know, in Santa Fe, outside of Santa Fe, and, you know, just meditating or sinking into fundamental well-being.
Living in a tiny house somewhere.
Yeah, or buying a tiny house somewhere. All the trends that we see in our research populations, right? The tiny house thing is new. It used to be cabins.
Okay. We got to keep updated.
It's tiny houses. It's gone to tiny houses. That's totally true. And so, you know, the Exemplar program is designed to help people with integration. And so you can get to that from the Explorers Course mini course. I think it has its own URL too. It might be exemplar.world or exemplarprogram.com or something. It's terrible that I don't know things like this, but you can tell I'm like focused on the research.
You're working at the high level here. thank you so much.
Googleable.
Dr. Jeffrey Martin, thank you so much for being with us today. Your work is incredible. Your spirit's incredible, and it feel like it's a real service to humanity. So thank you for that. And thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank all of you guys who are watching. You can find me at my website, lisacampion.com. Stop by and say hi. And thank you for joining us. Thank you for being with us. We're right here on Empower Radio in the Miracle of Healing. Thank you.